For this series, we are taking up studies in the life of Moses. And tonight, more or less, will be an introductory address based on Exodus chapter 1. Reading, please, from verse 1. Now, these are the names of the sons of Israel. Notice the change, please. These are the names of the sons of Israel which came into Egypt. Verse 6, and Joseph died, and all his brethren, and all that generation. The children of Israel were fruitful, and increased abundantly, and multiplied, and waxed exceeding mighty, and the land was filled with them. Now, there arose up a new king over Egypt, which knew not Joseph. And he said unto his people, Behold, the people of the children of Israel are more and mightier than we. Come on, let us deal wisely with them, lest they multiply and it come to pass that, when there falleth out any war, they join also unto our enemies and fight against us, and so get them up out of the land. Therefore, they did set over them taskmasters to afflict them with their burdens. And they built for Pharaoh treasure cities, Pithom and Rameses. But the more they afflicted them, the more they multiplied and grew. And they were grieved because of the children of Israel. And the Egyptians made the children of Israel to serve with rigor. And they made their lives bitter with hard bondage, in mortar, and in brick, and in all manner of service in the field. All their service wherein they made them serve was with rigor. The king of Egypt spake to the Hebrew midwives, of which the name of the one was Shiphrah, and the name of the other Puah, and he said, If it be a son, then ye shall kill him, but if it be a daughter, then she shall live. But the midwives feared God, and did not as the king of Egypt commanded them, but saved the men children alive. The king of Egypt called for the midwives, and said unto them, Why have ye done this thing, and have saved the men children alive? Verse 20, Therefore God dealt well with the midwives, and the people multiplied and waxed very mighty. It came to pass, because the midwives feared God, that he made them houses. Pharaoh charged all his people, saying, Every son that is born ye shall cast into the river, and every daughter ye shall save alive. Thus we have read the background to Moses' birth and life. Just keep your Bibles handy, won't you? The book of Genesis has to do with beginnings and doctrinally teaches the truth of election. That is quite clearly seen. It is constantly the choice of God. So it was that away back at the beginning, God chose Shem, one of the three sons of Noah, that ultimately from him there came the nation of Israel. Then coming a little closer, you will recall that God chose Abraham, one of three sons, who would become the father of the faithful. Then you will remember that God set aside Ishmael and chose Isaac. Yet again he set aside Esau the firstborn, and he chose Jacob. Yet again he set aside Reuben, the eldest of the 12 sons, and chose Joseph. So that right throughout the book of Genesis you are impressed with the sovereignty of God, the election of God. When you come to the book of Exodus, it has to do historically with the exodus of Israel out of Egypt, but doctrinally it teaches redemption. And time and again you have heard the preachers on Egypt as a type of the world, Pharaoh as a type of Satan, and the great work of God to bring Israel out of Egypt, redeemed by blood of the Lamb and redeemed by power at the Red Sea. But of course you will appreciate, as I indicated when I read verse 1, now these are the sons of Israel, that there is an aspect in which you find the sons of Israel in bondage in Egypt. And of course we are going to see later, I don't know whether you've been taught these things or not, we'll come to that in a moment. We're going to see later that Egypt, along with other places, is typical of the world system that surrounds us. But more about that later. Now, you will notice that the book opens with this expression, the sons of Israel, drawing attention to their dignity as the people of God. Now, let me bring it over a moment into your New Testament. Now I want you to appreciate tonight that sonship is the greatest blessing of the present day. There is nothing greater or higher or more wonderful than the fact that you are a son of God. Now, because there is an allied truth connected with that, would you please turn over to your New Testament to Galatians chapter 4. Let me point out one or two things to you. Galatians chapter 4. In this instance, you're as well to turn to it, that by reading it, you might learn certain fundamental truths. Galatians 4 at verse 4. When the fullness of the time was come. Now, that's a point in the divine calendar. A moment when it pleased divine wisdom to intervene in the affairs of men. There had been a fullness reached. That is, the revelation of God had come forward to a certain point. And when that point had been reached, verse 4, God sent forth his Son. Wonderful moment, wasn't it? I spoke to you about it at the conference when I dealt with the truth of the virgin birth. Now, read on. Made, born, come of a woman. That's the virgin birth. He was born of a woman. He wasn't born of parents. Do you remember I told you that God brought in Adam without the agency of male or female? He brought Eve in without the agency of a female. You and I enter this world through the agency of male and female father and mother, our parents. But he entered into the world when he came in. God used the agency of a woman, but not a man. So he was born of a woman. That, notice, he is the Son of God. God sent his Son. Secondly, he's a real man. He's born of a woman. Thirdly, look now, born under the law. So he's born a Jew, subject to the authority of the Jewish law, and he will maintain the righteousness of that law throughout his life. Now, notice now the reason for this. To redeem them that were under the law, that we might receive the adoption of sons. That we might receive the position of sons, not children. Now listen carefully. As a child, as children, we are born into the family of God. But as sons, we are placed in the position. Adoption indicates that you have a place that naturally you're not entitled to. Got the idea? So that you're born by new birth into the family of God, but you are placed by God as a son before him. You've no right to that position. None at all. God adopted you. It is really son placing. So that, notice, the moment that you were saved, you were a son of God. You maybe didn't know it like the preacher, but that's what you were. Look again. Verse 6, and because ye are sons, God hath sent forth the Spirit of his Son into your hearts, crying, Abba, Father. So the moment that you were saved, you were a son of God, and that same moment you received the Spirit of God. Now you grasp that. Now let it simmer. That will save you from Pentecostal error. You receive the Spirit at conversion. This is not the only basic text that teaches this. Now, if you young people can get these things in, you'll be saved from a great deal of what's going abroad. Got that? So that you are a son of God. Now, I don't know how much you appreciate it. For instance, if somebody met you someday and they said, excuse me, but living around here or working with you, I notice that you're different from other people. Would you mind telling me, what are you? Come on now. What would you say? You would likely say, well, I'm a Christian. I don't suppose it would ever dawn on you to say, I'm a son of God. Why? Well, the neighbour might get a shock. Now, can you just think for a moment? You say, what? A son of God? That's right. Now, can you grasp the dignity of that? Can you understand you have a relationship that's not of this world at all? And you stand in the dignity of a son of God. Come on, square your shoulders and get your chin up. There's nobody like you. That's right. There's nobody like us. We're the sons of God. It's wonderful, isn't it? That's relationship. That's character. Isn't that right? You'll meet someone. And they'll say, you don't need to tell me who that is. That's so-and-so's son. Isn't that right? I wonder if that's... Wouldn't it be good if they could say that of us? You don't need to tell me. I can tell. You're a son of God. You're like your father. Now let's come back again to Exodus 1, please. So down into Egypt, now look at verse 7. Four things. The children of Israel were fruitful. One, increased abundantly. Two, multiplied. Three, were exceeding mighty. Four. Now you can appreciate this, can't you? That this is natural fruit. This is physical. This is the people of God numerically. And of course, when you go over to the book of the Acts and you enter the new dispensation, you get the same thing. You find them multiplying. Now, right, 120, Acts 1. Acts 2, 3,000. Acts 4, verse 4, 5,000 men. Acts 5, multitudes of them. Got it? Now, first of all, they were fruitful. Now, of course, obviously, in meetings like these, I want to give things a turn in order to apply them spiritually to us. Are we fruitful Christians? Now, what does that mean? Well, now, you go to John 15 and you'll read this. The Lord says, I am the true vine, and ye are the branches. Every branch in me that beareth fruit, he purgeth it that it might bring forth more fruit. He that abideth in me and I in him, the same bringeth forth much fruit. Got it? Fruit, more fruit, much fruit. Now, what is fruit? What is fruit? Well now, fruit is the expression of the life of the tree. Isn't that right? Fruit is the expression of the life of the tree. Christ is the tree. To produce fruit is to express Christ. Isn't it? Now listen to what John 15 says. Listen carefully. I am the vine and ye are the branches. Every branch in me that beareth fruit, that's positive. He purgeth it that it might bring more fruit. That's comparative. Once you produce fruit, now you produce more fruit. He that abideth in me and I in him, the same shall bring forth
Much fruit, that's superlative. Fruit is positive, more fruit is comparative, much fruit is superlative. Let me go back. So that when you're converted, you produce fruit and you begin to reproduce the life of Christ. Is that right? Now, don't be too quick to answer. Listen, this world has only known two kinds of men. Adam and Christ. The first man and the second man, the natural and the spiritual. Which man are you reproducing? Come on now. For to me to live, Christ. That's it. That's it. And that's what we're looking for in young converts. We're looking for Christ expressed in your life. Now, we are told that if you produce fruit, every branch in me that beareth fruit, he pruneth it that it might produce more fruit. So that means in the passage of time you become more like Christ. And if you abide in him and he abides in you, the fullness of fellowship, you'll produce much fruit, the superlative. Now, am I right? Now, do you folks, don't be afraid to tell me if you differ with me. Am I right? Fruit, more fruit, much fruit. Does that mean this? That the youngest Christians are producing Christ? Those of us who have gone on a bit more, we are producing more of Christ. And the older saints are producing most of Christ. Is that right? Would you say amen to that? Now, don't you understand that this business of Christianity is all about Christ? It's all about Christ. Now, I shall be in the lookout along with you. 4 years since I've been here. Say, do you think you will see more of Christ in me than them? And I in you? Come on now. More of Christ. That's it. The church is a continuation of Christ. Now let's get down to the basic things. Come on. Again, look again. The increase abundantly. That's the same word as in Genesis 1 verse 20. Let the waters bring forth abundantly, let the waters swarm with swarming. That's it. What is it? It's the whole, whenever you look around you, the whole place is swarming with life. That's it. Vital energy. You go to the Acts of the Apostles again, and there are thousands getting saved. Everywhere you looked, there were Christians. The place was swarming with spiritual life. They were just ordinary folks. But they were turning the world upside down. Look again. They multiplied. Is that right? Multiplied. They waxed exceeding mighty. Now I could go on like this, but I don't want to stay in the verse all night. But you can see that the whole place is swarming with life. That's it. Now, look now at verse 8. That's the verse that governs the chapter in the book. There arose up a new king over Egypt that knew not Joseph. Therefore he didn't feel under any obligation to Joseph's descendants. And verses 9 to 14. He looks out over the land. And he notices that the children of Israel are growing stronger and stronger and stronger. So he calls a cabinet meeting. And he says to his counselors, now listen. Let us deal wisely with these people. For if somebody invades us, if they turn with the enemy, we are finished. And he says, we'll need to deal with this. Now, you switch it right over now to the spiritual realm. You'll understand this, that when God is blessing, there's somebody watching. Wherever you get the blessing of God, you'll get the activity of Satan. You read the Acts of the Apostles and you'll get the devices of Satan against the church at large. You read the epistle to the Corinthians and you'll get the devices of Satan against the church local. Brethren and sisters, it's high time that we awoke to the fact that the devil's busy. All New Testament epistles were written against a background of trouble. We've got trouble from inside and we've got trouble from outside. You remember yesterday in the Bible reading, I drew your attention to the fact that a great deal of the source of trouble in local churches today is coming not only from carnal Christians. A lot of our trouble is coming from the fact that there are folks amongst us who are not converted. And more than that, you've got the devil constantly attacking us. And you can appreciate this. So here, you'll notice, please, verses 9 to 14, he's attacking them from the outside. He set over taskmasters to afflict them. Verse 11, please. And they built for Pharaoh treasure cities. Imagine. Imagine the sons of Israel beautifying Egypt. That's what Pharaoh's got them doing. He's got them building treasure cities to beautify the Egyptian system. Oh, the tragedy of this business, of Christians being occupied trying to make this world a better place to live in, when it's getting worse all the time. See the danger. See energy deflected into wrong channels. Verse 12. But strange. The more they afflicted them, the more they multiplied and grew. That's right. You grind them down and they'll spring up. It was the same in the early days of the Acts. The more they persecuted them, the more the thing spread. Say, dare I say it? Could we do with a little of this? To purify our ranks and multiply our numbers? Over yonder there's an underground church. Many of them can only meet secretly. They're being hounded and persecuted, and in their private prayer meetings they're praying that the Church of the West might get a little persecution to stir them up from their materialism.
Makes you think, doesn't it? Say, we never had it so good. How little for God. Now, I want to talk to you now about this Egyptian system that was bringing them into bondage. Now, have you been taught these things? Now, once I mention them, you'll know whether you've been taught them or not. I'm talking now in relation to the world system. Have you been taught, please, the difference between the Sodom system, the Egyptian system, the Jericho system, and the Babylonian system? Now, you'll know now whether you've been taught them or not. The difference between the Sodom system, the Egyptian system, the Jericho system, and the Babylonian system. All various aspects of the world system that surrounds us. Now let me talk to you about them. The Sodom system is the world of filth and dirt and sex that's all around you, that you find in your glossy magazines, on the hoardings, that come over radio and TV. It's a whole world around you that worships the god of sex. That's the Sodom system. Now the Jericho system. Do you remember that when Israel entered the land, that Jericho straightly shut up its gates against them? So that Jericho is barring the way into the land. Now Canaan is not heaven. You know that. Canaan is not heaven. Canaan was the place of the inheritance for Israel. They had to fight their way in. So that Canaan represents the truth of God, enshrined in the scriptures for your enjoyment and mine. Now, are you enjoying the things of God? Now, have you?
Now you see, the possibility is that the Jericho system standing, holding you back. Now what is the Jericho system? Well, the Jericho system is this world controlled by evil spirits that's prepared to hinder you enjoying divine truth. Now I'm back at the devil again. When you go up to the epistle to the Ephesians and you read about all the wonderful truth of God, when you come to verse 12 of chapter 6, we wrestle not against flesh and blood, but against principalities, against powers, against the world rulers of this darkness. What does that mean? It means this. That there are evil spirits opposing us on our way in to enjoy God's things. That's the Jericho system. Now the Babylonian system. The Babylonian system is religion without Christ and without the cross, that finds its centre today in the World Council of Churches, and will find its apex in the Babylon of Revelation chapter 17 and 18. And all around you, you've got that system. Men taking public places on platform and pulpits, supposedly to represent God and to deny every fundamental truth in the book. Do you remember at the conference on another aspect of this I taught you about Philistine principles? Here you have Babylon all around you. A vast system, and gradually they're uniting it. Ecumenicalism. And ultimately, by the time the church goes, it will be a vast amalgamation of everything that will ultimately prove to be anti-Christian. Babylon is not only Roman Catholicism, it's everything that's anti-God and anti-Christ. That's why in Revelation it says, come out of her, my people. And there are well-known evangelical figures that are even prepared to go along with it today. And they'll have on their platforms unconverted men and professors and archbishops. Now all that's making for Babylon, because a lot of good men associated with things that have never heard God say to them, come out of them, my people. Now the Egyptian system. Now the Egyptian system is quite complex. First of all, the Egyptian system stands for independence of God. You remember the book says, woe unto them that go down to Egypt for help. You see, Egypt was independent of heaven. Egypt worshipped the Nile. They depend on the Nile to overflow its banks. Rain falls very seldom in Egypt. It falls away in the hills and is brought down by the river Nile. And they worship the Nile. It fertilizes the earth and it overflows its banks. Egypt is independent of heaven in their outlook. This world breeds independence of God. That's right. You go out and move amongst worldly men, they're living without God. The only time you hear the name is in blasphemy. Independence of God. It's a very real thing. Secondly, the Bible talks about the wisdom of Egypt. Moses was learned, instructed in all the wisdom of the Egyptians. That is the scientific culture and acts of this world. Isn't that right? Oh, the progress that's been made. Man's a wonderful creature, you know. Never you write him down. And don't write him off. Man's a wonderful creature. You know, when I consider sometimes there seems no heights that he can't attain to. That's right. I can remember the time when it was impossible, they thought, to break the sound barrier. To go into space. Never. Lunar space couldn't be done. Put a man in the moon. Impossible. Even the brethren said it. Saw him. And they'll bring him right back to within a few hundred yards. And men that have never been up there will tell you what the conditions are and give them space suits to meet the conditions successfully. Man's a wonderful creature. Scientifically made advancements. Yet the Russian says, I never saw God up there. Say, has it made America or Canada or Britain brought them any nearer to God? It's
furnishes men with an independence of God, the greater they become. Yet the same man can grovel in the dirt and the mire of sin. He's a complex being, is man.
Come again.
The Bible talks about treasures in Egypt. That's the thing. We never had it so good. After all, there's nothing wrong with having money. The Bible never condemns it. But it does warn you that it takes a steady hand to hold the cup. But you look around you. In the mad race of the commercial world, the more you penetrate it, the deeper you'll become involved. Let me go back to the weekend again. Do you remember I indicated to you that at the judgment seat there will be no rewards for being a successful businessman only? No rewards for being a sales executive only? Nothing wrong with these things. But if it's choking your spirit, your life, and the devil's got you in your knees, then the treasures of Egypt are getting a grip.
Again,
the Bible talks about the pleasures of Egypt. It's pleasures. Very easy to turn to them, isn't it? You young folks, very easy. See, be honest. I mean, after all, there's no harm being honest in the presence of God. You're not answering me. I'm not wanting you to tell me. You can tell God. Would you rather watch the baseball on the television than come to the prayer meeting? No, that will just put exactly where you stand. Would you rather go skiing at the weekend and attend the conference? Now please, you make your own application. Because you'll understand this, that different aspects of the world would appeal to you more than what would appeal to me, and vice versa. We're built different. But there are certain things. You see, what you go in for when you're alone in private will tell you where your weakness lies. What you turn to in privacy is where your weakness lies. So that the pleasures of this world can attract. Again, Egypt was a place of idolatry. All the plagues were against the gods of Egypt. Against all the gods of Egypt will I execute judgment, and all the judgments. But God brought in all these things. Were all different gods in Egypt. And when God brought the plague in, he was defying the Egyptian gods and overcoming them. It was a place of idolatry. Place of idolatry. Say, what's your God? Come on now. Silently in the secret sanctuary of your personality, at what altar do you bow? Got it? Can you see the danger of the Egyptian system?
Can?
Vast, complex thing, isn't it? Now come again, please, will you? This time, you'll notice when you come to verses 15 to 21, 22, that the devil changes his tactics. He's not now attacking from outside, he's attacking from inside. That's always his way. If violence and threat won't accomplish it, then he'll move inside to undermine the people of God from the inside. Isn't that right? How did he break down Corinth? From the inside. He got the brethren at loggerheads with each other. He broke it down from the inside. Oh, how blind we are. How blind we are. Don't seem to realise how clever the devil is. And the same thing goes on all over, and it recurs time and again. Paul was a great man. He says, we are not ignorant of his devices. That's good. See, the devil can trip you up even in the name of truth. That's right. Now watch. Verse 15.
So he gets a hold of the two midwives.
Now he says, listen.
Whenever you're doing your business,
if it's a son, kill him. If it's a daughter, let her live.
Now you step back, please, and survey this in all its breadth. And you can see an attack immediately upon the seed of Israel to cut off the Messiah Christ. If you kill all the male children, the nation will die out and there'll be no Christ to come through the nation. Isn't that right? Wasn't that true later on when he destroyed the seed royal? And God intervened and saved one. Come again. So that he issues his instructions. Now look at verse 17.
But the midwives feared God. You see, the devil's not omniscient. He's not omniscient.
Now he was setting up his throne here in Egypt to attack. Now I know you're thinking that's a strange statement.
Well now, listen to this. Writing to the church at Pergamos, the Lord said, I know thy works and where thou dwellest, even where Satan's throne is.
Now,
that means this. That the devil didn't dwell at Pergamos, but he set up an administrative throne at Pergamos to attack the churches.
That's where his throne was.
Got it. He sets up an administrative throne in certain places. Where do you think it is today? Come on, brother. We're down now at fundamentals. He sets up his throne to attack the churches. You see, you're dealing with spiritual things. It's high time we've instructed about these things. Mind you, it's not easy talking about these things. Have it frightened.
Sunday night at this young folks meeting,
I was speaking to them, speaking quite straight, bringing before them the claims of Christ, and I said to them, now I'm getting frightened. I said, for this reason, the last time I spoke like this, three engagements were broken. The devil might be after me shortly for this tonight.
Satan's throne, and he's attacking,
but he's not omniscient. It never struck him that the midwives would refuse to do what he said. The artists depict the pharaohs as wild beasts. What could two women do against an autocratic monarch that had life and death in his hand? What could two women do?
But listen to me, will you? Women are more courageous than men.
The weakness of the vessel but will magnify the power of God. Isn't that right? The weakness of the vessel will magnify the power. If two women will defy Pharaoh, that will prove that it's not them, it's God that's doing it.
The midwives fear God. And the fear of God will hold you when your intelligence won't. You mark what I'm saying.
The path of testimony is strewn with shipwreck of men and women that knew their Bible far better than ever you and I'll know it.
That's right. But if you can get your heart set in Christ, that will hold you. The midwives feared God.
There was a reverential awe of the eternal. And it came out in this, that they decided they would obey God rather than Pharaoh.
That's good.
That's good. Obey God rather than man.
The midwives feared God. Listen to this. It's so sublimely simple.
My, if we'd been writing this, we'd have written chapters about it. Just the same as I'm talking about it.
How does the Bible put it?
Oh, the paucity of language. Concentrate. The midwives feared God and did not as the king of Egypt commanded, that's all. And that was all there was to it. They weren't going to do it.
That's all. Just as simple as that.
The answer was no.
Now, do you ever meet the devil?
Well, I know you're beginning to think there's a bit of a strange boy up here. Now, let me ask you, Do you ever meet the devil? Do you believe in him? Well, you say, don't be silly. Listen, do you believe in the devil? Do you believe in a personal devil? The Lord did, you know, and he met him. I've met him. I could take you to places where we've had it out. And we parted as we met, sworn enemies. But he doesn't like me. And I don't like him. Very real thing. Very real thing. And they said, it says, they did not as the king of Egypt commanded them. So the king of Egypt called them and he says, now, why are you not doing what you were told? They were facing death. He had their life in their hands. What could two women do? Now, here's what it says. Well, they gave the reason for it in verse 19. Told Pharaoh the reason for it. That was the end of the thing. Isn't it remarkable how God restrained Pharaoh? He accepted the explanation and that was that. You'd have thought he went into a rage, but God was overruling. Verse 20, therefore God dealt well with the midwives, and the people multiplied and waxed mighty. And it came to pass, verse 21, because the midwives feared God, that he made them houses. That is, he built up the families. That's the idea of making houses in the Old Testament. He built up their families. He gave them children and built up their house. Not a little house, but their families. In other words, God blessed them for their stand. Now listen to me. The devil's convincing everybody that you're a loser by turning to God. Isn't that right? You go out into the world. They'll tell you you're a loser by turning to God. The devil's convinced the world that you lose by turning to God. He's convinced lots of Christians that you'll lose if you're going about and out for Christ. They'll close certain doors. It might mean a certain sacrifice. Now let me go back to the conference again. Do you remember the appeal I sought to make to younger men? If need be, to do with a few hundred dollars a year less and do something for God. After all, the Lord's coming. The Lord's coming. The Lord's coming. And if he comes very shortly, what then? Only one life. Will soon be past. Only what's done for Christ will last. And I tell you, it'll not sound very good at the judgment seat to say, well, you know, Lord, I was waiting till I got through my career, and I needed all my time. I hadn't time for the meetings, and I hadn't time to study, and really, I wanted to get to the top, and then, but it's too late, Christ has come. Now please, don't misunderstand me. There's nothing wrong with ambition. There's nothing wrong in getting to the top if you're not sacrificing your spiritual life on the road through. That's it. We want you to be something for God. And the secret is this, that the midwives fear God. Now look at the last verse of the chapter. Pharaoh charged all his people, saying, every son that is born ye shall cast into the river, and every daughter ye shall save alive. My, that's simple, isn't it? Eh? My, that's very effective, isn't it? Listen again. Pharaoh charged all his people, saying, every son that is born ye shall cast into the river, drown them. And every daughter save alive. But if you drown all the children, the male children, there's no seed to perpetuate Israel, and the nation will die out. Very effective, wasn't it? Just kill the male children. And it was in that background and in those circumstances that Moses was born. Why? This is the very time we would have chosen that he shouldn't be born. He wouldn't have fit into our story. This is the worst time. For if Moses is born, he'll be drowned. Is that right? But if he's God's leader, he won't. But how will God do it? My, it's thrilling, isn't it? How will God do it? That'll be the story tomorrow, I think. How God does things. You see, when everything's at its darkest, that's when God's going to break through. That's right. When the storm clouds have gathered and the roar of the devil is heard, and into the world there comes a wee tiny struggling infant. God knows. Eh? He'll drown in the Nile, don't you believe it? Eh? God will preserve it.
But you know how he did it? How he did it was wonderful.
How he did it was wonderful. Have you ever read Exodus 2? It covers 80 years in Moses' life. So it's quite important. Now you'll read it before tomorrow night, won't you?
80 years in Moses' life.
It'll take God from Exodus 3 to Deuteronomy 34 to tell you about the other 40. And it'll all start later on at the burning bush, and we'll be there, I expect, by Thursday night.
Now you men listen to me.
Moses lived till he was 120, isn't that right? The burning bush began his great job of leading God's people. He started his greatest business in life when he was 80 years of age. Two-thirds of his life was gone when he started his greatest work for God. Eh?
Man, when two-thirds of our life's gone, we're thinking about retiring.
We're thinking of getting out. We're opting out.
This man's beginning his greatest work for God.
For there is no substitute for maturity. There is no substitute for experience. But there's a lot to go through before he reaches the burning bush. He's a lot of lessons to learn, and so have we before we reach our burning bush. And tomorrow night, if the good Lord spares me, and with those who gather together, we'll find out the ways of God to preserve the child. And Pharaoh can roar as much as he likes, and he can give out all the edicts that he cares. If there's one thing sure in this world, it's this: that Moses won't drown.
Moses can't drown.
God will preserve him. I can look back in life. I can trace the hand of God in life before I was converted. And I wasn't converted till I was 19. And I wasn't reared in a Christian home. But I can trace the hand of God preserving, obviously having viewed something that I never knew existed.
That's right.
Never knew anything about Brennan. Gospel halls. A young Irish evangelist came to preach for a month. In the third week of that month, I got converted. You know, quite distinctly. When the meeting's finished and they went away, I walked down the road after the last meeting and said to myself, I wonder what they're going to do up in that hall there now that the minister's gone. I thought the thing would come to an end. Oh, yes, I did. I thought it was all built round the man on the platform. I hadn't a clue. If you had said to me in the road down that night, they tell me you're converted, Jack. They tell me you're born again, Jack. And I said, sorry, I don't know what you're talking about. I wouldn't have had a clue. I didn't know the language. Listen, young folks, have I told you what I know God taught me in the few years that followed that, when I'd go into the bedroom to read my Bible? I told you, didn't I? And the fire would go out, I've got a big overcoat, hasn't it? At 2 o'clock in the morning, Mother would come and push me off to bed. Well, I didn't think I got very much. God knows that even yet, things come back to me, I must have read them. That's it. So if the Lord will, we'll continue with Moses tomorrow evening. Let us pray.